right. Welcome, everyone, to the latest installment of the MP Access podcast. I'm David Wharton, editor-in-chief of Mortgage Point and the Five Star Institute. We're here today on site at the Legal League Servicer Summit 2026 here in Dallas, Texas, and we're speaking with some of the speakers and subject matter experts and industry folks that are here in attendance. Today, we are speaking with Clayton Gordon from McMichael Taylor Gray. And Clayton, welcome to the podcast, and thanks for taking some time to talk to us.
Thank you for having me here.
Well, we got a lot to talk about, but just to kind of set the groundwork, could you give us a little background on what you do there at McMichael Taylor Gray? I believe your title is Director of Complex Litigation and Strategic Development, which is a great title, I must say. And what does that mean? What does your day-to-day work look like? What do you do there at the firm in the nitty-gritty of it all?
Well, I think the best way to unpack the title is to use an analogy.
Okay.
So let's talk about football. I know it's a little bit early.
No, let's go for it.
But I am the offensive coordinator up in the booth, and I'm looking down on the field, and I see our team out on the field getting ready to run a play. I take a look at the defense, and I see how the defense is lined up. My role is to step in there and provide guidance, provide the right play to make sure that we overcome those defenses and score points. Essentially.
So within the field of law, obviously, there's a lot of areas you could focus on, lots of expertise, lots of paths you can take. So I'm curious, what led you into the space of mortgage servicing and foreclosure law specifically? How did you end up there? And I know we talk to a lot of people who end up sort of falling backwards or sideways into this industry. So I'm curious if that's the case.
It's a long and tortured background.
Sure.
Let me share it with you. So I started out right from law school working for an insurance defense firm in South Florida. And I had some great experiences there. I learned a lot as a fresh lawyer on how to approach litigation, how to engage in discovery, how to handle depositions, and things like that. The one thing that I didn't know how to handle well was my boss. So that led me to having conversations with some of my old law school friends, and one of them worked for a foreclosure firm in Fort Lauderdale, and I thought, hey, I'll try this out. It's the same basic thing. We're still litigating. It's still in my wheelhouse. So I went over to this firm, and it was right before, this was early 2000s, and it was kind of the heyday of mortgage foreclosures before mm-hmm. the regulations started appearing. And it was a lot of fun, it was interesting, and as an aside, it's also where I met my wife. So but that job there, it kind of petered out. I realized that I wanted a little bit more than just what I was doing there.
Sure.
And I had an opportunity to go work for a maritime firm. And just as an aside, when I was in law school, I concentrated on international law and maritime law.
So, okay, interesting. I was going to say, that's an interesting aside for sure.
Right. So I found this opportunity and I took it, and that's really where I started to develop my appreciation for and skill in handling complex litigation cases, because there you're dealing with international law, you're dealing with insurance, maritime insurance, which is way more complicated than it should be, but it is what it is, and the evidence required to sustain your claim or defend your claim was immense. There were literal rooms full of documents in there. And so that's where I really cut my teeth on the complex litigation work. And I was intending to stay there, but my dad passed away and I had to move back home and to help out with the family. And I got a job working for a title company and handling real estate closings. So I was starting to steer back towards the foreclosure world,
yeah.
And then the Great Recession happened, and I lost my job. So I opened up my own firm and started handling foreclosure defense work and bankruptcy because it was easy income and I needed something right away. And ultimately, that led me to working for a mortgage servicer. And then 12 years later, here I am. So it wasn't intended.
Yeah.
Kind of like a lot of other people in this industry, it wasn't intended. I didn't go to law school to handle mortgage foreclosures, but I have no regrets.
That's a good place to be. Well, for people who maybe don't work in litigation or are working in other parts of the industry, could you talk a little bit about what role complex litigation plays within the servicing industry specifically?
Complex litigation is when things sort of go off the rails. It's when what you think is a straightforward case develops a problem where maybe you don't have the evidence that you need, or maybe there's some evidence in there that isn't the evidence that you want in there. And sometimes it involves other parties filing claims against other people. And so its role is to handle that stuff that is not normal.
Okay.
And that's really the role that it serves. And it also serves as kind of a watchdog, because when you're in this realm where there are different issues and different pieces of evidence that are being applied in ways that they're not normally applied, it can lead to the court's ruling perhaps the wrong way. And perhaps that ruling is upheld on an appeal, which then creates havoc amongst those of us in this industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a two-pronged thing. Number one, you deal with that specific issue that's being addressed through that litigation, but you're also keeping watch out there to make sure that it doesn't do anything to unnecessarily harm your client or the industry at large.
Well, and you mentioned the timeline of coming in before or around the time of the financial crisis and everything. So I imagine the complexity of things has gotten a lot more complex since then, just as far as what you have to deal with and the kind of map of states and everything else. Over the past few years, we'll say since the 2008 financial crisis, or even nearer term, obviously we've had a pandemic since then and everything else. So what are some of the trends that you've seen emerging specifically in foreclosure related litigation? What are the complexities that you've seen develop there, and how do you guys pivot to try to deal with those?
There have been several developments over the last few years. Obviously, New York is on everyone's mind with
Sure.
the statute of limitations and the Foreclosure Abuse and Prevention Act, which is kind of an oxymoron. There's always something new. There's always something changing. And over the past few years, we've got this statute of limitations problem. We have borrowers now challenging more often how their loss mitigation reviews are being handled by servicers. And so these things are starting to come up more in foreclosure litigation. And well, here's another kind of a strange example. Before COVID, FHA had this rule where you had to go knock on someone's door.
Right.
And the face-to-face mm-hmm. regulations, I'm sure the audience is pretty well familiar with it. You had these face-to-face regulations where you had to, with few exceptions, go knock on the door, provide the borrower with the information that was required, and try to work out a deal right there at the door, which is impossible to do.
Yeah.
So you already start out with unreasonable expectations by Congress and by FHA. So then that develops a cottage industry around that one rule. And in Florida, there was a few different defense lawyers. They made their entire career out of defending this one rule.
Right.
And so that was one of those trends. You have a new rule develop, then you have a whole then it usually follows a few years worth of litigation to address that rule, to address that regulation, and see how it works out.
Right.
So, and ultimately, it falls kind of one or two ways. One, the industry has to change, or two, defense firms and borrowers have to come up with another thing to pursue.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's generally face-to-face regulations. It's HUD, other HUD regulations and other things in there, and those have become more and more litigated over the last few years because, well, the simple premise of mortgage foreclosures is you broke a contract, I'm going to take your house.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get the collateral back. So the whole role is to find out different ways to overcome that and muddy the waters a bit. So, but over the last few years, it's loss mitigation has become a much bigger theme in the defense world, as well as you're just picking out little regulations here and there and seeing what sticks.
Having been through a couple of periods of turmoil, you know, with the financial crisis and the pandemic and everything, obviously the landscape of homeownership has changed since then. So are you seeing things change materially as far as who is ending up that you're dealing with that reaches that foreclosure stage, given that a lot of people have more equity in the home? And how has that fundamentally changed what you do and how you do it?
Generally, I would say no, it hasn't fundamentally changed anything. It's just changed the approach on how to resolve the default, right?
Okay.
So because we have the equity there, we as an industry, we want the borrowers to rehab that loan, get it performing again, and just move forward. However, part of the problem is, and it's a bit kind of me being a skeptic, is you have these defense counsels out there who, in my own opinion, prey on some of these borrowers who really do need help.
Right.
And what happens is that a bunch of litigation erupts over loss mitigation, over different federal claims, which even if there's not really anything there, they're going to file the claims. And then what this does is this causes the servicer, this causes the foreclosure firm to expend way more money and time dealing with those issues. And all this does is eat up the equity that the borrower would have had available.
Mm.
And so it's where there aren't as many foreclosures out there. And so the defense bar still has to eat. So they're doing it now at the expense of the borrower, again, in my own opinion. And that's really where things have changed a bit more.
Well, you mentioned the FDCPA, and we hear a lot about claims coming out of statutes like that one or UDAAP. Being used more frequently right now. Could you talk a little bit about how those claims are impacting litigation strategies?
So oftentimes those claims are raised simply as a bargaining chip.
Okay.
And it's used for a couple of purposes. And when I was doing defense work, I did it too.
Sure.
Right? So my goal was to make my opponent blink. It was to get them to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe we have a problem here. Maybe we need to settle and give the borrower something more than what they're entitled to just to make this go away, because mm-hmm. I don't want to have to defend this case. I don't want to have to spend the money on it, whether or not that claim is valid or not.
Right.
So many times it's often used for that purpose. However, sometimes, it's not very often, but sometimes those claims are valid. And you just can't assume that when someone files a bunch of what seemingly appear to be frivolous claims and defenses, you got to pay attention, because sometimes there's some meat on those bones and that's where you could get into trouble. So always keep an eye on that. but know that, you know, generally we're looking to see, all right, what does the borrower really want, right? Mm-hmm. What is their end game here? Is their end game here to get a better term on a loan modification, or is their goal to get some sort of a cash thing, so to set them up for a down payment on a rental or something? So
that's the way
I've approached it.
Well, I think that transitions kind of nicely into the next question. So you kind of touched on this a little bit, but what are some of the other more significant legal risks that servicers need to be aware of when they're navigating just all of this web of foreclosure or default-related litigation?
So there are a number of legal risks out there, and sure, my hair is a little bit grayer because of it.
Sure.
But some of the main risks are, and this is something when I was at my old employer.
Mm-hmm. The maritime law, or
no. When I worked for a mortgage servicer, One of the things that always worried me in the background was, how is this case going to affect us? How is it going to affect our investors? And what's it going to do to the industry?
Mm.
One of the things that you never want to happen as a practitioner is your case being the one that ends up having to transform the industry because of a bad ruling, bad facts, or something like that.
Right.
So when you're talking about risks, you're always looking for those things in the background, and it's not necessarily something that a servicer can plan on or anticipate, but they're out there. All it takes is perhaps a bad set of facts in one isolated case. Maybe it's something where, do we really want to pursue this claim? It's a low enough, the balance is low enough. Is it really worth that risk to open ourselves up, our investor, or the industry up to additional liability or scrutiny? So I hope that answered your question. That's what I'm always thinking, especially when it comes to appellate cases. Those are the ones that really concern me the most, because it may be that on the surface it appears that it's a simple issue and you're going to get a simple affirmed or denied response. But sometimes, especially in states like, say, New York again, states like New York, you have some appellate judges that want to fundamentally change things. And is it a judge being more of a legislator, perhaps the jury, no pun intended, is still out on some of those judges and some of those opinions, but those are some of the things that can really affect the whole industry. Well, for example, there was a case in Maine a long time ago, which completely is the Greenleaf decision, and that completely upended years of foreclosure law in that state. All it took was one decision. And those are the risks that you're always looking out for. But it's not always something you can anticipate.
Yeah, for sure. Well, obviously, I know we heard a ton during COVID. Obviously, you'd hear about court backlogs, and that made sense because the whole world was having to figure out how to deal with that and transition and up. Change the way we did everything. What does that landscape look like right now as far as court delays or jurisdictional issues, backlogs? What does it look like now compared to, you know, 6 years ago at this point?
I'll share with you a tale of two cities.
Please do.
City number one is the state of Florida.
Okay.
Which does things the right way generally.
Okay.
And then there's the state of New York, which does things the other way. So what the state of Florida did, And I applaud the legislature and I applaud the courts for really the Florida Supreme Court for doing this. And what they did was kind of transformed how civil litigation works in that state. So they decided to base it off of the federal model, which under the federal model, you want things resolved quickly. And so the courts are constantly trying to churn through its cases as quickly and efficiently as possible, because you don't have the resources simply to hold on for cases to just kind of linger out there for years and years, and it does nothing but prejudice the parties. Even if you ultimately win, if you have a 10-year-old case and you win, you're still prejudiced because there's 10 years where you weren't remunerated for whatever the issue was, right? So 10 years, that's 10 years of interest that you didn't get. Or 10 years of not being able to use that money for something else, for example.
Right.
And on the other hand, as a defendant, well, you ended up having to pay more because all of the ongoing monthly interest. So it doesn't help anybody in the end. So what Florida did, and there were quite a few examples out there, Florida cases just lingering out there too. The Florida Supreme Court said, enough. And so they changed this model, and there's a lot more focus on making sure that those judges in that state manage their court dockets efficiently, and they change the rules to make sure that everyone does things quickly, efficiently, and if there's something complex, well, they'll divert it. But that's the way it should work. Mm-hmm. New York, on the other hand, well, so here's an example. There's a civil rule of procedure in New York which says that a judge has 60 days to rule on a motion. 60 days after the motion's been submitted. These 60-day turnaround periods have taken more than 2 years. And so when I jokingly said the Foreclosure Abuse Prevention Act is kind of an oxymoron, well, this underscores that problem because the state of New York isn't doing anything to address that problem. That's the problem. There's not enough funding for the judges. There aren't enough judges to manage the caseload. And the legislature's simply not interested enough to solve that problem.
Right.
Because by solving that problem, you're also solving the foreclosure abuse prevention stuff, too, because everything's getting done more quickly.
Mm.
So that and so we as the practitioners are left with, okay, depending on the state you're practicing in, it's either easy or it's way overburdened.
So could you talk a little bit about the role that collaboration plays between servicers and their legal counsel when it comes to navigating these cases? What does that relationship look like?
I want to be clear. There is no higher, more critical function than the collaboration between a servicer and their law firm. Cases are won or lost at court, but the cause of a loss or the cause of a win is solely based on that collaboration between the servicer and the law firm. Let me explain. So you have a case, a regular foreclosure case, and the law firm is going through some of the evidence. Let's say it's a payment history, and there's something there that looks a little off, something out of the ordinary.
Right.
Well, if you can't communicate that problem to the servicer, and if the servicer can't give you a good response to that, that can be a real problem.
Sure.
And it's these little things like this that can lead to a loss, or like we were talking about earlier, risks, unintended consequences. So it's really important that both the client and the attorney work together to solve these problems, because the law firm is there to help the servicer solve their problems, right? And so that teamwork, it's essential. It's going back to playing football, right? It's having a quarterback and a center, but no one else on the field.
Sure.
You're not going to win, right? So you need to have everyone out there. Everyone needs to know what the game plan is. And so everyone has to play together to execute that plan and score the point.
sort of building off that, is there advice you would give to servicing professionals, specifically who are trying to have sort of that proactive mindset of staying ahead of regulatory or litigation risks within the environment?
I think the first thing that these professionals should do is follow Mortgage Point. That's first and
foremost. Love to hear that. Thank you.
First and foremost, that's where you start. You can also look to resources like the Legal League, where you have these collaborative environments with mortgage servicers and the law firms. This is the safe place where everyone can get together and work on these ideas, anticipate what these trends are going to be in the future, and learn how to deal with them. And that's really the way to go about it. I am so happy to be a part of Legal League, where we get to do this, and it's such a collaborative environment, and there's so much knowledge and there's so much wisdom between all of the parties here. It's really the place to be. And if you've heard it here, you know what to look for out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Well, we appreciate those kind words, certainly. Well, I know before we started recording, I know this was the one that you said you could probably really say a lot about. So for our guests, we like to throw this one at them, but is there one change that you think could, and it doesn't have to be one, but one or two, that could really improve the mortgage servicing and legal landscape as a whole? Is there a fix out there that you see, or just like, if only that could happen, that would solve so many problems?
As a former mortgage servicer employee, and we're really in the midst of a revolution right now,
okay.
The whole AI revolution.
Sure.
And being able to condense all of that information out there, just looking at one mortgage file, having the ability to condense all of that information and provide you with the information you need to make those decisions to get the job done, that is a huge leap forward. Now, there are some risks involved, but that technological revolution is really going, and I'm excited to see what it's going to look like in the future, because you're taking all of these tasks that previously would take hours to do, and you can consolidate it into maybe a few keystrokes to give you exactly what you need to do your job. It's amazing. And that, especially when you're dealing with constant changes in regulations, mm-hmm. constant changes in the case law out there, having these tools out there will really help keep the mortgage industry ahead of the game, anticipate what those trends are going to be in the future, and then develop around it. AI is the tool to use in the future. Now, go ahead.
No, please, because I think you may be headed where I was going to follow up.
That being said, the other thing that guarantees success in the future is people.
Mm-hmm.
Because as great as AI is, and it's a great tool, and I think it'll be a transformative tool in the future, in the end, it all comes down to people. AI is a tool. It doesn't make decisions for you, at least not yet, I hope. So you need to take the time and the effort to develop the people who make the decisions. Teach them what it takes to make those decisions. Explain the why behind why certain decisions need to be made as opposed to others. And so by developing people just as much as servicers and law firms are developing their AI capabilities, don't forget about developing the people who in the end are the ones that end up controlling the end result, right? And the end result, what is the end result? Is to make sure that our customers have performing loans and they're doing what they need to do to keep their house and to have that American dream that they're looking for, right? And these are just, AI is just a tool, but it's people, and it's people dealing with people in the end.
Well, that really brings us back to the importance of events like this and getting that chance to have those conversations in person and meet some of those great people that are out there. And maybe the next hire you meet at one of these conferences or something like that.
But, that's right.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Clayton. Do you want to plug your website or anything you guys want to throw out there?
It's mtglaw.com.
Okay, cool.
So, of course, everyone's happy. You know, everyone's welcome to go visit our website, check us out. I'm always around. It's cgordon@mtglaw.com if anyone ever has any questions.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Clayton. It was good talking to you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. We'll be back with more conversations here from the Legal League Servicer Summit and on our next episode of the MP Access Podcast. Thank you for watching.
Thanks for listening to MP Access. Stay up to date with daily mortgage news, featured stories, and our latest episodes of the podcast at themortgagepoint.com. Don't miss out, and we'll see you next week.